Hey everyone, I want to tell you about a benefit that's going on this weekend in Austin, Texas. It's called The Song for Pam, and it'll be going on this Sunday, November 11th, at Don's Depot from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's a $25 ticket, but that's because Jerry Jeff Walker is playing, Bob Schneider is playing, Penny Joe Pulis is playing, and I'm playing. So that's this Sunday, November 11th, from 4 to 9 p.m., A Song for Pam, Don's Depot, Austin, Texas. Let's do it!
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Tom Howdy.
Hello. I hope you're doing good. You out there? You out there hanging out, living the dream, listening to a podcast? It's a really beautiful day today, and I've spent it inside interviewing and recording people. So that's the kind of person I am. I went out a couple of times and chilled out. Oh, I went for a run this morning. I did. It was great. And today is the day after the election, so we have the same president, and that is the political portion of the show. I did make some beef stroganoff for the election night meal. I made it from scratch. It came out pretty well. At the end, you add this Greek yogurt, and when I went to go add the Greek yogurt, I feel like I might have lightened the color a little bit to where it was a cross between poop and vomit. It doesn't look very pretty, but it tastes pretty good. I still have some leftovers, so I tossed that on some egg noodles, and I made some Brussels sprouts, because I got to tell you, I was raised in a family that didn't feed you Brussels sprouts, and then I discovered them on my own, like at a friend's house for dinner. I was like, why is there miniature lettuce all over my plate? I was like 9 or 10. Their mom was like, you never seen Brussels sprouts? And I come from a place where Hispanic people, they're not Brussels sprouts people. We're not Brussels sprouts. So I had to do that on my own, meeting various white people out there. So I'd go to their house for dinner, and then I'd always be like, hey, man, will you make Brussels sprouts? But then apparently the kids that were exposed to them on a regular basis hated them. But I loved them. I like anything, really, that you cover in butter. That's the truth. I love anything covered in butter. My guest today is Joshua Zarbo. He's an amazing bass player, and I've been around him, a few times over the last, couple of decades or whatever, and always been a really nice guy. I've seen him play a lot. He's really, really talented bass player and a really cool guy on stage, and he's a really cool guy in life. He played with Spoon, Bob Schneider, John D. Graham, tons of people. I've always really kind of, liked him. I've been like, oh, man, he's a nice guy. So I'm glad he got to come over. We got to sit down. We got to talk. I got to know him a little bit. And it's funny because the first song I'm going to play, it turns out he didn't play on, but it makes sense after a little while. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. I really did. This is Joshua Zarbo. You play bass on that, right?
I didn't play bass on the song.
What?
No.
I gotta play a different song then.
That's all right. but a little personal connection to that is I was in a drop D metal band called Requiem.
Darren told me that.
Yeah.
Tell me about that band.
Well,
is that a band from Virginia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was my last band before I left Virginia and moved to Texas and all that stuff. But I think what happened is that Britt had the lyric.
Right.
He kind of had the format for the lyric. He had something about a drop
I'm going to change the song.
That's all right.
Before it's retarded.
He had an idea for the lyric, and I think what I just remember about it is when we were recording the record, he asked me, were you in a Was your band Requiem a drop D metal band? And I said, yeah, definitely we're a drop D metal band. And that's.
Did you write songs in Requiem?
I did.
What was your role? Was it a band? What was it?
It was a band. It was like a collaborative, great collaborative, fun band. It was just a bunch of guys that I met like right after high school, right when I started college. People that I didn't go to high school with. I think I just met them around playing shows with some of my bands from high school, and then I can't remember, but somehow we just all started kind of clicking and seeing each other at shows. And
what was like a band you can tell me that I'll be like, oh, okay, with that you were like maybe two bands. Like it's a pitch.
Iron Maiden and Queensryche.
Fuck yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, we were like a 5-piece band and dual guitars with like harmony leads, and we were way into like prog metal, like Fate's Warning and Yes and Dream Theater and Queensryche and Iron Maiden, kind of that kind of progressive stuff.
I don't think I've ever heard Dream Theater.
You know, I got into them briefly because my metal years kind of ended. When I came to Texas, because when I came to Texas, I transferred directly to UNT in Denton,
right.
And I just met people from all over the country who were into way different things, and all my metal listening kind of, not to disparage it, but it just completely dropped off, and I started listening to like the Smiths and the Velvet Underground, and that was kind of like my next phase of growth and in music and just music listening and being a fan and stuff like that.
Cool. Joshua Zarbo. Is that really your name?
That's me, yeah.
So you're Italian?
I am, man. Yeah? Yeah, well, technically, Zarbo is a Sicilian name.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Tell me about growing up in Virginia. What was that like?
It was great.
Yeah?
I was born in southwestern Virginia, like Roanoke.
Okay, yeah.
I grew up in a little, I grew up in Roanoke, and my parents and my brothers, well, my brothers were all born in Pennsylvania, and my parents are originally from Pennsylvania, and I think they moved to Virginia just for work. But
I was what was that work?
Both my parents worked in healthcare. My mom was a nurse, and my dad is a nurse, and my dad works in like the healthcare industry. And so I think my dad was doing something for the county there. He was like working for like WIC or something like that.
Okay.
You know,
where are they at with Obamacare?
They both support it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So we're actually talking the day after the election.
Yeah.
So even though this will come out later. This is a pretty big day.
Yeah, it's a huge day.
I thought for a minute last night when I was watching it that I was like, oh, uh-oh.
Like scared, like Romney, nervous.
Yeah, like at the very beginning of it. Yes. And I think they do that. When you watch it on TV, I think they just do this thing so you'll just keep on watching.
Dude, I think we're on the exact same wavelength.
Yeah.
I agree. My wife and I have just been totally disparaging. Even left-leaning, which my wife and I are.
Well, that's just
left-leaning programs and stations and
it's
news,
not news.
It's not news. They just draw it out and they.
It's there's so Rachel much Maddow is just like Glenn Beck, but the other side.
Very true.
Just kind of.
I mean, I appreciate what she has to say.
Sure.
And she's a brilliant.
Well, she agrees with people.
But I agree with you that there's become this whole polarization because people are finding a lot of kind of prosperity and doing that line of work, you know. They're finding a lot of employment in that kind of work, you know. And so they're just milking it for what they can, you know.
Yeah.
I think to the detriment of the country in a lot of ways, but
sure, because there's people that aren't that strong-minded.
Right.
That really get wrapped up in it and, you know. I know this is totally off the subject, but I saw a documentary the other day about those kind of news things. I can't remember what it was called. But eventually, you know, things like that, the way that people rile up the crowd,
yeah,
you know, ends up in something like someone like Gabby Giffords getting shot, you know.
Yep.
Which pretty much
happens. Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, people would start expressing extremist views and much more, you know, they're much more outgoing about it. And it's
Were your parents like chilling. Political growing up? Because it seems like Virginia would be kind of conservative, is it?
Well, yeah, except for my dad is like, he's only like a second generation kid from both sides of his family. Mother and father are first generation Americans, all Ellis Island kind of people that immigrated to the U.S.
Oh, cool.
And my mom is much more of a independent-minded. She was raised in a much more kind of split family, I think, where my grandmother was probably maybe more Democratic-leaning and my grandfather was more Republican-leaning. But also with them, just more kind of socially liberal, economically, you know, a conservative. So, you know, no, both of my parents were pretty, I mean, I don't know if I would say liberal as much as moderate. And
right.
They voted more Democratic, although my dad's side of the family were involved in Pennsylvania politics and Democratic Pennsylvania politics and
right.
stuff like that. So they were pretty hardcore Democrats.
Yeah. My family's
and blue
Cuban.
Collar. Yeah.
That comes from Cuba, so they're pretty Republican.
Right, right. Yeah, my wife and I were talking about that last night because we were talking about Miami and we were talking about the non-Cuban Hispanic support for Obama in
right.
Florida. And my wife was like, why are Cubans usually more Republican? And it's because of Castro,
it
right?
It is because of Castro. Well, it actually, I would say, a mixture of Castro and all Democrats to them are John F. Kennedy, who, you know, screwed them over in the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
And kind of what Cubans view as let that happen.
It's crazy how this stuff plays out for decades and generations
yeah,
and generations.
It really does.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's dudes driving trucks around in Alabama and Mississippi with, like, the South will rise again. And it was 160 years ago, you know, or something like that, or however, 150 years ago, you know, it's just...
So what was it like growing up there? Was it... It was
well, and
beautiful,
yeah.
And did you do a lot of outdoor stuff? How did you get interested in music?
Well, particularly in Roanoke, it was much more kind of idyllic, you know, because it was part of the... I think at the end of the Shenandoah Mountains or the Blue Ridge Mountains go through there, and it was beautiful, and I have two older brothers. We're all pretty close in age, so we went outside and just had a great time. I didn't get into music until we moved to Northern Virginia when I was about 10.
Okay.
And around the age of 12, I have a cousin who basically, without him, I probably would have never gotten into music, who comes from a really large family. And he was involved some way in an early form of the Stray Cats with Brian Setzer.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And he's from New York. His name's Eddie Von... Well, his name's Eddie Wombach, but he goes by Eddie Von Bach. That's his...
That's cool.
That's his stage name. And he came to visit my
he's
family.
He's still out there jamming?
He's not jamming as much, but he still lives in New York, and I think he's like a Teamster now or something.
Okay.
But he still writes music, and he still gets up and plays shows, you know, and stuff like that. He came to visit my family when I was about 12, I think, and there was a music store around the corner from my neighborhood, and he took me to the music store, and my friends were getting into it. It was kind of a culmination of things. You know, music was becoming a more prominent place in my life, and then my cousin Eddie came, and he was like, you should do this, and we went to that music store and checked out some instruments, and I started saving my money, and maybe summer before high school, I bought my first bass, and my parents made a deal with me. They said, if you buy the instrument, we'll pay for the lessons. And
what was the bass? Why bass?
You know, I wanted to play drums, but where I grew up in Northern Virginia, we lived in townhouses, you know,
right.
which
yeah,
are
yeah,
like
yeah.
five houses
so
connected together. So, and my dad was like, no, no drums.
Yeah.
And so got a bass because it was a Fender bass, and it was pretty much the only brand that I recognized in the store. And a lot of my friends were picking up guitar, and I like Gene Simmons.
Yeah.
You know, and...
what year was that?
This is 1987, maybe?
Okay.
Yeah, 87. So, uh-huh. 20.
How old were you?
I'm all 39, almost.
40. No. How old were you then?
I was 14.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, it was around the same time.
Yeah.
So who were you... you like Gene Simmons? Did you like Masked? Kiss, or at that point it was like Lick It Up and
yeah,
Let's Put the X in Sex.
It was Animal. It was, you know what, a friend of mine from like elementary school and into high school, he had an Animalized tour VHS show,
yeah,
you know, on VHS cassette, and we used to watch it. I think it was from Detroit or something, and Gene Simmons came out with like the cod piece on, and
yeah,
like he played this bass that was the Axe bass.
Yeah.
And he did a solo, and, you know, and I was getting into people like, you know, Nikki Sixx and Steve Harris from Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
And those guys were kind of all starting to really blow me away. So that's kind of what happened. And it just seemed like I'm not like a real front center stage kind of guy. That's just not my personality in music. You know, I have the different kind of personality, which is more of a you know, a bass player's personality, yeah, more supportive and kind of hanging out with the drummer and stuff like that. Yeah. So that's how I got into it. And then the social component of it took over and I just got way into it, man. You know, I just got into like rock bands outside of school after school, and I got into bands in school, like jazz band and marching band, and I just did the
whole... Isn't it so great?
Like, it was amazing.
It's like you, all of a sudden you have like these friends and everyone thinks alike. And...
Totally. And you got to get out of class.
Yeah.
For events, and you got to travel, like the bands that I was in school, we got to travel for, you know, band contests and stuff like that down in the Carolinas, and you know, I would get to go away for a week when everybody else was still back in Virginia in school, and it was awesome. You know, and those were my first experiences in like professional recording studios, you know, and it was really cool.
Yeah. And it gave you the you were like sold. This is totally what I'm gonna do.
I mean, I was, you know, I wasn't really raised around musicians at all. You know, right. There was no music really in the house as far as like an instrument or a piano or anything like that. I mean, we barely even had a stereo, but you know, so I was apprehensive about doing it for a career, but I just knew that I didn't want to do anything else either. You know, there's always that kind of fear about it. Like, wow, how am I going to, this is like a weird thing to do for a living.
Right.
You know, but I didn't want to do anything else. So
yeah.
I just followed through with it.
Was there any plan B, like any kind of like, well, maybe I'll do this, this guy.
Well, when I got to UNT, I was a music major for maybe like 2 weeks, you know, and, I kind of pulled a fast one on my parents. I've never really told them this, but, you know, I wanted to go and get out of Virginia and go to Texas because I wanted to meet a bunch of musicians and I wanted to play in bands, and I wasn't really that interested.
What year was that? Like the early 90s?
Mm-hmm, 92, 93.
What was the thing? Was there a specific? Were you like...
This is
where Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians came from. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, no. I had never even been to Denton. I had never even been to UNT. I didn't even visit the college before I transferred there. I just went there because I was studying upright with a guy at the college that I was going to in Virginia. And I was really kind of discouraged. And my girlfriend at the time had just dumped me. And I was just looking for like a new path in life, just a new adventure. And he said, you should go to the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas. And I was like, okay. And so I started looking into it, and I have a little bit of family in North Texas, an aunt and uncle and a couple cousins, and just was like, yeah,
that was it.
I don't have anything else to lose. And the band that I was playing with, the Requiem band, was doing all right, but you know, Northern Virginia's music scene, yeah, there's like Fugazi and Minor Threat and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's like DC, a punk scene, yeah.
But the rock scene was much more kind of hair bandy and kind of lame, and there wasn't like a real organic aspect to it or like a scene. You know, when I got to Denton, that was my first experience of like a real thriving kind of just, you know,
who was there then? Who's hanging out?
It was like
that
time.
After the Earl Harvin.
Well, that was still going on. Earl Harvin was still going on. Yeah, and like there was a lot of like large ensemble funk bands like Whitey and but then there was like Brutal Juice and Cock, and that's when like right when I went there was kind of when the whole Seattle thing was really exploding.
Yeah.
You know, and independent music was starting to come up, and those are the first kind of shows that I started going to were independent shows down in Deep Ellum, seeing bands like Big Chief, I mean, bands that nobody even hears of anymore, and Six Finger Satellite, and we had there was this really cool club in Denton called the Argo, and you know, like Thrill Jockey, I think, had a bunch of bands that came through there, like the Sea and Cake and Tortoise, and John Cale came and played with like his orchestra or his ensemble, and that's where I met the guys. That's kind of how the whole Spoon story kind of turned out, was that club there. That's where I met them.
Oh, really? Because they were playing as Spoon at the time.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what happened
was it when Britt was still doing the he used to play acoustic guitar through the amp.
Yeah,
that was fucking awesome.
Yeah, it was a trio, and basically, long story short, kind of, I had seen them a year prior, like November of '95. A buddy and I, we were in a band together. We went and saw Pavement in Dallas at the Galaxy Club.
Uh-huh.
And Spoon, I think, had recently been signed or was about to be signed to Matador, which was Pavement's label.
Right.
And they blew me away. Spoon blew me away. And I was pretty close to where Britt was on the stage. And I just remember watching him, and he was just going for it, you know. Yeah. And I hadn't really seen a local kind of unknown band. Local Texas band just be that great. And, and so the next year, we found out that they were coming to Denton to play a show on a tour that they were doing. And my friend and I, who were still in the band at that time, we were pretty close to the people at the Argo, and we got on the bill. And then, just coincidentally, they were having problems with their bass player at the time. I think they had a fill-in guy. And they saw me playing that night. And Jim came up to me and started kind of talking to me after the show. And I think one of the things, too, that was kind of funny is that I was breaking down the drum kit and packing it up and stuff. And Jim came up to me and was like, why are you, you know, we had already met maybe a few minutes earlier. And he said to me, why are you breaking down the drum kit? And it was kind of the band's kit, you know. It didn't really belong to the guy that was playing drums with us at the time. It belonged to the singer. And he's like, why are you breaking down the drum kit? And I was like, oh, I like doing this. I like breaking down the drums and packing up the van. And he was
you want to be in a band?
Yeah. You want to be in my band? And I think he and Britt had a little powwow during my band set and was like, you know, that guy's bass sample fit in the van and he can play bass and he doesn't look like a freak. And
yeah,
it just kind of started.
What was your look? Were you, was it 95, 96?
I don't know what it was.
The early 90s are pretty bad. I was in this band, Mr. Rockababy, and I wore like flowered tights and just a vest and a top hat. That was fucked up. But then afterwards, I'm not too ashamed of what I look like.
I don't know. You know, man, I've never really been... I'm more of a reserved guy, so I've never really gone for much of a look. And when I have, it's been really bad.
Yeah.
Like when I had big
Requiem?
Hair. Yeah, when in Requiem, I used to do like kind of like the, like Queensryche was trying to do. They were like a metal band, but they also had kind of like a stylized image. So, you know, so I was wearing like these long sleeved shirts with my...
Kind of puffy.
Yeah, I was kind of puffy shirt. Yeah. And it was like the collar was buttoned all the way up to the top. And maybe I had like a chain necklace coming out on the outside.
Yeah.
But then I had really long hair, you know, like, and I was probably only like, you know, 5 feet, 2 inches tall and like 110 pounds, but yeah. I had like 50 pounds of hair on the top of my head, you know? But when I started playing with Spoon, it was completely different. By then I'd cut my hair and I was just, I don't know what my look was. It was probably just college, you know, just like unwashed.
So,
and
let's go back. 'Cause you said you went in and you started majoring in music for 2 weeks and you had never told your parents this. And then you went off on something else.
Yeah, I did. I changed my major and I did history.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want to tell your parents that?
I didn't want to tell them that, hey, you know, I'm not really here to do a music program. I'm here to, like, meet people and play in bands. And I realized... I had an interest in history. And I knew that if I was going to do a music program there, it takes, like, 150% of your life to do a music degree. And I knew that I wanted to have the flexibility to not have to be like 24/7 in the music building doing, you know, scales and working on sight singing and ear training and all the stuff that you have to do and playing in five ensembles and stuff like that. And so
the 1 o'clock and the.
Yeah. And I'd had kind of a disastrous interview with one of the guys there who just like crushed my soul. And I found that a lot of one of the UNT faculty music guys. And I found that I didn't like the environment of the music department there either. It was so cutthroat and people were so arrogant and so brutal, you know? And I didn't want to study jazz at that age either. I mean, I love jazz, but I was coming from playing Queensryche and Maiden and I was getting into like the Smiths and stuff. I didn't want to.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like you would get along in that program very well.
No, and I wanted to have the flexibility to be able to go to class and then also be able to play in bands and hang out with people, and you know, that's what I did. Yeah. I'm glad I did, you know, because it allowed me to experience the Denton music scene more, you know.
So when you got how soon after that show and their conversation with Jim and Britt did you get into Spoon?
It was pretty quick. I mean, that was probably end of 96.
Is that when they got signed to Elektra?
No,
a little bit after,
like the Matador relationship kind of deal was coming to an end. Because when I started playing with them, regularly was early 97. So within a couple months, I had come down to Austin a few times and auditioned. And then I did a tour with them on the West Coast in February.
And was that your first tour?
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was absolutely amazing. We played some awful shows on the way out to LA, like to like five people, sure. You know, in Phoenix and stuff like that. But then we got to open for Pavement at the, I'm going to forget this now, but the, kind of the big hipster enclave there in LA. We got to open up for them. And I think like a member of the Beastie Boys was out in the audience, you know, and we're opening for right. Pavement.
Yeah.
And,
it's all going on. Yeah. You're in LA.
Yeah. And then we went up to San Francisco and we played Noise Pop Festival and we played at Bimbo's 365, which is an amazing venue. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met Ron Lafitte, the guy from Elektra for the first time. And then I got to play in Seattle at the Crocodile Cafe and it was amazing.
So what happened with Ron when you met him?
You know,
he really loved you guys. I know. It's. I mean, maybe he blew smoke up my ass because he thought maybe there's a chance I would run into you guys. I was signed to Lars Ulrich's label.
The music
but
label.
He was the guy. He was the Elektra guy that would come and talk to us.
And
tell us
because he was pretty tight with the Metallica guys.
Yes,
you know, and that. I mean, yeah. I mean, I. You know, Ron Lafitte was a really nice guy, but. You know, being an outsider, because I had only been playing with the band for a few weeks,
yeah.
But getting to see it for what it was, because by that time, Jim and Britt had already been through the whole kind of bidding war with before they signed to Matador. And so they were kind of getting used to being around those kind of people. And I liked Ron Lafitte, but he also completely struck me as a completely LA guy. He pulled out, I remember at the venue in San Francisco when I met him, you know, he pulled out like a gold Amex card and said to somebody who was working at Bimbo's, like the staff, like, get these boys whatever they want, you know, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, and I was just
isn't that
like,
funny now?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
It is.
Like, yeah. It's funny. But I remember whenever you're going through this, you're like, fuck, this is it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the apple of this guy's eye.
Yeah.
He likes me almost as much as me.
Yeah.
This is fucking awesome.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember he took us, I think this was the same place, I mean, the same time, he took us out to eat that night before the show or after the show, and we had a tour manager with us who was wearing, like, this pullover kind of hoodie, and it was just, like, you know, it was like had been eaten away by moths, but Ron Lafitte took us to like this posh San Francisco restaurant. And when the guy came to, you know, the concierge or whatever was taking our jackets, this guy gave him like his, you know, moth eaten hold up, you know, pullover. And it just seemed kind of comical in that way too, you know.
Because you probably also had like $4 in your pocket and then you ate like $1,000 dinner.
I was completely broke. Yeah. I mean, we all were, you know.
Totally surreal.
Yeah, it was
so then you guys went up, you did that tour, and when you got back, you joined the band?
Or how did that happen? It was kind of a little touch and go for a while, but yeah, I did, you know. We started working on the songs, you know, that Britt had already written, I think, quite a few songs for what was to become a series of sneaks.
Yeah.
And so we started working on those and we started, I think that's when we started recording. It was like after that February tour. We were supposed to do an East Coast tour, I remember, but that got canceled because I think those guys were totally burned out because they'd basically been on the road for like a year straight, because that's kind of how Matador wanted it to go.
Yeah.
And I think
and then
they
not just with you, they had to keep on working in new guys and stuff.
Yeah, new bass players. And I don't think that they were seeing the returns that they were told they were going to see.
Right.
And I think that they were seeing that they were playing towns where records weren't in stores like they were supposed to be, you know. And so I think they thought, you know, we're burning ourselves out here. Why don't we just cancel this East Coast tour and just concentrate on. And so that's what we did. And I was still living in Denton at the time. I commuted down from Denton to Austin for about a year and a half while I was first playing with them. And then I moved to Austin.
It's a commitment. You really wanted to do it.
Oh, man, I was just totally into it.
Yeah.
Totally into it.
So. What a great band to have be like your first real band.
Yeah.
You know? You know, those records that you guys made that you were on are, you know, I don't, you know how you, I'm trying to think of, there's records that you know the words to and you sing along with when you put them on, like almost kind of like Beatle records, and they feel good when you put them on. Those records are like that to me.
Cool. Well, thanks, man. That means a lot. I mean,
Not just me, obviously. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of our contemporaries, guys like Darren and, you know, things like that, they have that, you know, when we're all in the van and we put on, you know, one of those songs comes on, everyone starts singing along. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that kind of was immediate about playing with that band was how good of a songwriter Britt was and how he had a real vision. And that was the thing that kind of took it up several notches for me, you know, about that band, was that, you know, I was dealing with guys that were totally committed to it, totally serious about it, had a vision, and were kind of unrelenting about making it happen. And it was a really great.
And were you having a good time too, or was it hard?
I was having a good time, but it was also really hard because I was joining a band where things had
kind of... already in place. Sorry.
No, totally. Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, like, you know, there was already established roles, and I was coming into a role that had been very tenuous and fractured. Right. They had an issue with the original bass player, with legal issues with her, and, you know, and so... And they were kind of in the doldrums a little bit because things hadn't gone the way they thought they were going to be going with Matador. And you know, so it was a bit of a darker time in a way. But
you might have added some fresh energy to it, though. Maybe being new to everything, like, oh, this is awesome. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that helped, especially with my relationship with Jim. You know, he and I bonded really well right away. And I think that helped the dynamic of what the band sounded like as a performing live band too. You know, I think it took it up a notch, which was fun, which made me feel really good. So,
So when did you guys, how did you do Series of Sneaks? Did you do it in LA or did you do it here?
No, we did it all here.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did it with, John Croslin.
And right.
We did it with a bunch of studios. We did most of the initial recording sessions for it were done at Cedar Creek.
Uh-huh.
And
is that Steven still around? Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yep. I think they've kind of expanded into like a mastering suite, and they do DVD stuff. But that was just unbelievable because Fred Remmert had like a classic Neve console that Elvis had apparently recorded on during his RCA years, and John Croslin was just a really great guy, and he was really encouraging, and he was really positive, and. And so we did a lot of initial stuff like basic tracking, like drums and bass, I think, there. And then we started kind of, and that was done like in a big chunk, like in a week or something like that, like a week or 10 days. And then the overdubbing and some more songs came down the months as we did like stuff at like Hit Shack and Music Lane. Yeah. And then we did some stuff, you know, like Metal Detector. That's one of the tracks.
Oh, right.
And I think the bass for that I recorded in Britt's apartment, and we did that like basically on like a Tascam audio cassette 4-track. And so there were some really cool kind of lo-fi moments to it too, you know. So, and it took a little while. It took probably spring of 97 all the way through the summer into the fall, I think, of 97, and then it got wrapped up, and then they started figuring out who was going to release it, because the band basically, well, I think Jim basically paid for
funded
record.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and so then the Elektra deal, and that's when all that kind of came afterwards.
And Sylvia was president when you guys were there too?
Yeah, she was. Yeah, she
did. Do you ever meet her? I met her once.
Yeah, I did. You know, yeah. A little joke that Britt and I have is that I met her one time. When the record came out, we went to New York and we went up to the big meeting room, and she came, and I think she's like from Brooklyn or something.
Yeah.
And she said, I think we could have a lot of fun together. You know, she said that to me like when we were meeting her, and it was kind of, you could kind of see the writing on the wall as far as like the relationship kind of souring, because you could tell that like their launch party for us was like hastily arranged, and like they ordered a bunch of like pizzas at the last minute, and like they brought in a bunch of the executives, and we took a bunch of pictures, and then everybody left, and the record was like kind of playing at like a low volume, and it was just kind of corny, and the three of us were kind of standing there going, I don't know what's really going on with this, but, you know. And I think that what did it last, like 5 months? You know,
I don't even know, because I remember we got signed, and I mean, we had a really crazy time, but during that time, like Lafitte left right after we got there, and it's like 98 or something
like
that.
Yeah, well, that's what happened to Spoon, too, you know? Yeah. I think the band signed in March or April, you know,
right,
like shortly before the record came out, the band signed, I think, and then we were dropped by September, and we were dropped because Ron had left, and then Sylvia basically went through his roster and said,
clean house.
Yeah, basically, these are the people. And I don't think that we had been championed by him. Like, we had a really, really, really good relationship with the commercial music people, mm-hmm, but that was it. You know, we hadn't, I think that they thought, a lot of people thought that Spoon was going to be kind of this, like, monster where it was going to have a lot of credibility, but at the same time, it was going to have a lot of commercial success.
Yeah. I mean, and just being somebody that kind of was, heard them talk about you to us, like, you know, watch what we're going to do with Spoon. You'll see that. You guys, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, was Gowdy signed to Elektra proper or to music?
To the music company, but it was all of Elektra's money and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we met Sylvia Roan at a showcase that we did at CBGB's.
Wow.
And we had this crazy English tour manager named Nick Brown, who actually, he joined the army when the Iraq War broke out.
Whoa.
Yeah, so he could kill dudes. Seriously. And so anyway, I'm still in touch with this guy. He's a unique character.
Yeah.
Extremely unique. So he's so stoked this is all going down. All the label people and Lars is coming. He would always get really excited because he was a huge Metallica fan. And,
yeah.
So we're randomly talking to this somewhat hot black lady.
Yeah.
Just kind of by the dressing room.
Yeah.
That's what he sees. So he comes up behind her and literally humps behind her and goes, "Hey, boys, New York City, how you doing, darling?" And walks off. We were all like, oh, fuck. But I wanted to say this. I didn't know if your experience was like this, but like that movie, That Thing You Do.
Yeah.
When we met her, it's exactly what I felt like. Hey, so, you know, why are these fucking people talking to me? You know what I mean? That's exactly what I felt like when I was around her.
Yeah, I mean, she was nice. You know, she was polite. And she was obviously a very, like, powerful woman. And she knew what she was doing. But she definitely had, like, she was definitely, obviously, a CEO. You know, like, she had a bunch of handlers. And when she wanted something done, like she would, like, the whole pizza thing, which seems so hastily arranged. Like, you could tell that she was annoyed that, like, her people that were her underlings weren't handling it properly, and she was like, you know, where are these pizzas and why isn't this happening? And she was just, you could tell that she was kind of aggravated about the whole thing, but she also just, I also kind of came away from it that we were just like a number to her, you know.
It didn't seem like there was any sort of totally. When she was talking to us, totally. Like, I'm here, I'm doing this thing. This guy that makes my label a bunch of money wants me to say hi to you guys.
Yep. Yeah.
You know?
That's what
I felt like.
I experienced that so many times with so many different people working in the music industry, especially working with Spoon, you know? So, yeah.
So
that's kind of how it is.
So you guys get dropped, and what was the move then? The next record was Girls Can Tell.
Right. And so...
But that took a little while. You did it with Mike?
Yep.
Yeah.
And, basically just kind of figured out what was going to happen. Like, there was a lot of, I think, especially for Brit, just a lot of like self-reflection about, you know, what are we doing? What am I doing? And, and out of it came,
so he was getting to be like in his like 30.
Yeah. Late 20s. Yeah.
Late 20s.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's what led to the next phase of the band, you know, kind of rising from the ashes of that whole Elektra debacle, you know, is, I think he thought,
At first you guys did
we did the split single thing, yeah.
But the Agony of Lafitte?
Yeah, yeah, that's what happened out of it. Yeah, Hunter Darby, do you know
Hunter Darby?
Yeah, from the Wannabes. I can't remember if it was on a tour prior to that, but he had kind of helped or had coined those titles, you know, like, Lafitte Don't Fail Me Now and The Agony of Lafitte. And that's what happened. Britt wrote those songs, and then we went and recorded them with Dwayne Barnes over at a like his home studio over in I think like North Hyde Park, and so we did that, and that those songs you can kind of hear the kind of the beginning sounds of what was Girls Can Tell was going to be like, because you know Series of Sneaks was much more kind of inspired by like Bowie's kind of Berlin period and you know Wire and Gang of Four and Public Image Limited and stuff like that, and Girls Can Tell was much more of like the Kinks and the Beatles and you know those more, you know, for lack of a better term, those more like pop influences were starting to come out. And I think kind of through Britt's way of songwriting, they kind of manifested in a really cool, unique way.
They're not like carbon copy things ever.
Yeah, because they still
had.
You can
tell he's informed by these guys, but
totally. And you could and like Lennon stuff, like the early solo Lennon records, and you know, and you could kind of hear on some of the songs, you can hear like that residual influence of like the post-punk stuff, you know, which was pretty cool. But then you can hear the start of like the kind of, you know, rock, more straightforward rock and roll or pop stuff. Like, you know, what's the first song off of that record?
Everything Hits
at Once. And that's all right. I should know that. But you can kind of hear it. It's like, I always kind of tell people, like, Jimino and I, we sound like the rhythm section for Fleetwood Mac almost on that song, you know? And
yeah, there's a simplicity and just like, there's, you don't have to. That's a great analogy.
And that's the stuff that was starting to kind of come around.
That record always sounds to me like it was made in someone's house. Like there's like a living room sound of the drums and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of it was recorded with John Croslin at like Music Lane.
Uh-huh.
I think like Me and the Bean maybe was done there. And some of the earlier songs.
I love that song. Take That's like walk, one of my all-time favorite songs. Done there.
Cool. Yeah. Well, John Clayton wrote that one. He's great.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know that.
Me and the Bean, yeah. And then the later stuff started getting recorded at Jim's.
Right.
Like, at the time, it was a converted garage. And now he's torn that building down and created his amazing studio, Public Hi-Fi. But,
right.
But that's where a lot of this later stuff and, like, the bulk of the record, I think, from what I remember, was at that studio.
The theme song to this podcast, I think, was recorded at Public Hi-Fi.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
right on. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the other flip side to that whole, or the other half of that spoon coin is, you know, Britt's songwriting, but also Jim's kind of like amazing musicianship on drums. You know, Jim's like kind of like the topper headin of, you know, like the Clash guy Joe Strummer's obviously a great lyricist and a great ideas guy, and Mick Jones plays great guitar, and Paul Simonon's got this great vibe,
but there wouldn't even be the piano part
or the bass
Rock
part
the Casbah.
on Rock the Casbah. And I think what also kind of my point is that topper headin really just completely elevated the musicianship of that band.
Totally.
And that's what I think kind of what Jim did for Spoon. And then later years, kind of getting into the Girls Can Tell, Kill the Moonlight stuff, that's when like the engineering aspect of him started to come in, because that's when he started investing in like having a commercial studio.
Wasn't Mike working on those, right? Mike McCarthy?
Yeah,
Mike. He's been on the show. Did they hit, that must have been arguments that were amazing to be a part of, or just to witness. I love Mike in any argumentative situation.
You know,
I really do.
This interview is kind of cathartic. I hope that I'm not saying too many things that I shouldn't be, but who cares? But there was a point, it was either during Girls Can Tell or the recording for Kill the Moonlight, where there was a yellow pad and somebody had written like 20 times, "I want to kill Mike McCarthy."
Yeah, yeah.
"I want to kill Mike McCarthy."
I don't think Mike would get his feelings hurt by that.
Well, he saw the yellow pad too, of course, you know? Yeah. He like saw it, you know? And it was like, you know, it was definitely that kind of vibe. And you know what?
He's a great, I mean, yeah, like, I love that guy.
Me too.
He's high maintenance, though.
Me too.
And he's awesome, though.
You know, and as wonderful as it was, and, you know, I think that Girls Can Tell might have been the most collaborative as a band record that I think Spoon has ever made.
It feels like that.
But at the same time, the tension that was involved in it, because there was no label, and Spoon's kind of local, because this was prior to the record coming out, obviously, there are, you know, kind of our how we were being perceived locally was kind of fading a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just being in the moment. And that led to me kind of exiting the band sort of for a couple of years because it was really stressful. And it was, yeah. you know, and as great as that record was, it was really difficult to work with Britt during the making of that record, you know, because he was obviously changing his vision and that's a beautiful thing, but it was, he was really intense about making sure that that record was really, really good because I think he obviously wanted to make up for what maybe, well, just he wanted to make a great record, but maybe also.
But then also as a front guy in a band, like the pressure is a little bit different. And I remember R&R guy when I was in Gowdy saying to me, you know, if this record doesn't do well, those guys were in a great band that didn't get a fair shot and you'll be a failure. Like yeah. he literally said that to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm, you know, and
I'm sure, you know,
totally.
You feel that stuff when you're that guy.
Totally. And to be honest, you know, we had never really, the three of us, as much as we clicked musically and just as players, we had never really invested a whole lot of time in personal relationships, you know? And so even as close as Jim and I are and were, you know, so that not being there, that's usually what gets a lot of bands through those really kind of difficult, yeah. dark times.
Yeah, like you too. You know?
Yeah,
like
totally.
Those guys have gone through some fucked up
totally
shit, but if they weren't, you know, in the quote-unquote brotherhood, it would have ended.
Totally. You know, and when you don't have anybody really championing for you anymore and when it's really just about the band, that's when, I mean, it's so typical. You know, that's when things get really strained and,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, I went through that same kind of thing. I mean, I think that's totally. The story of most bands.
Totally.
Like, you know.
It's completely, it's very common.
Yeah, I mean, there's, Jim and Britt still play together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's,
they managed to do that, but I mean, still, you know, it's not the original guys, so they, you know.
Yeah, and kind of harking back to what you said, too, that dynamic had already been created, you know, like, it had been created when only two people were interested in Spoon, or maybe three right. people, the original bass player, Jim and Britt, you know,
right.
so the fact that they had been, and they had, Jim had been there since the beginning, and I think that, I mean, obviously, Britt would really appreciate that, because he had been so loyal, you know, Jim was like a guy who worked for engineering firms, you know, he was like a chip designer and, you know, he didn't need to be spending his holiday off time, you know, his vacation time touring in bands and sleeping on, you know, pull out couches or yeah. floors or, yeah. you know, and funding records and yeah. all that stuff, you know, so that dynamic there for them, that working relationship with them is so strong that's why I think it's also helped them kind of get through that. But being the guy on the outside kind of, or trying to figure out a way inside that
yeah.
is also kind of a yeah. weird thing to be in. So
what'd you do then when you left for a couple of years?
What did I do? I just like worked and I...
What'd you do working? Teaching?
No, I was working at like a, do you remember Pro Tape?
Of course.
Yeah, I worked at Pro Tape. And you know what? And I, as much as I kind of quote unquote quit the band, I came back and played on initial recording sessions for Kill the Moonlight, and I played regional shows, like shows that we did with Guided by Voices, and I was supposed to play CMJ for them, but then 9/11 happened, and you know, so we were still totally in contact, and I moved to Portland, Oregon for about 2 months. And
why did you do that, girl?
No, because this is like the story of my life. I'd gotten out of a relationship, kind of dumped by another girl, and I was really just kind of licking my wounds after the whole Spoon thing and figuring out what was going to happen, and so I decided I didn't want to be in Austin anymore, and so I kind of chose Portland, Oregon, and I'd always loved it when we toured through there, and so I went up there, but I happened to go up there like in the middle of winter when it's like yeah. the most depressing time to be there, when the sun goes down at 3 and yeah. it doesn't come up until 10 or something, and I like knew nobody and I had no prospects or nothing, and so I just kind of did that, and I played in I think I maybe was playing with John Clayton and Steve Collier and the Wright Flyers maybe during that time or around that time, and that's when maybe I started first teaching like bass lessons. And
how did you get into that?
I just kind of put a ad out and started first teaching friends, and then it just kind of went from there. You know, it was pretty small. I mean, it's still a pretty small time, but it was something I really liked doing.
Yeah.
So then
you went on to play with a bunch of, you came back from Portland and you started playing with some different people and working at Pro Tape?
Yeah, I mean, I came back from Portland, but pretty much by 2002, I got back in Spoon. Right before Kill the Moonlight came out, Brett and I talked and I expressed a desire to come back and play more shows with him or be on a more full-time basis. And he and Jim were into it. And so then I came back and then I was back into it for another 4 years or so.
And then things blew up even more.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. Did you go to Europe at that point?
Yeah, we did. We went to, I mean, they'd already been to Europe, but I hadn't been to Europe with them before. And we went to Europe maybe in November of 2002. And then that's when, like, That's the Way We Get By, tune started really kind of getting traction. And things had already been happening during the Girls Can Tell tour. Like, I wasn't in the band touring with them.
Right.
They had a guy playing bass with them, but that's when like shows started to, I mean, like small shows, but small clubs were starting to sell out,
right,
and they were starting to get some traction and like, you know, in the press about the band. And, you know, that's when, you know, critics really came on board. And so by the time I came back for Kill the Moonlight and started touring on that record, that's when things kind of went up to the next level. And that's when we started selling out more shows and, you know, multiple nights in cities. And it was amazing. That's when we started playing on national TV and did Austin City Limits. And that's when it all kind of started.
What all TV shows did you do?
We did Conan O'Brien. We did Letterman, but I think the next record we did Letterman. We did like, you know, Conan O'Brien and Carson Daly. And we did a lot of the really cool radio shows like Nick Harcourt out in L.A. show.
KCRW?
Yeah, KCRW. Yeah,
Morning Becomes Eclectic.
And we did Austin City Limits TV on that, on Kill the Moonlight.
Right, I remember seeing that.
Yeah, and then we did like just a bunch of festivals, and it was just, you know, we played, I think, two shows. I think like where I really realized that it was just going to go ape shit was when we did two, and I think the rest of the band saw this, we did two shows in New York at the Bowery Ballroom and they were both sold out, and it was the most incredible experience of my life probably with a band, because the audience was so just ravenous and just so into it that it just, when we came off stage and we did an encore afterwards, but their wanting of an encore, the audience's want, they sounded like they were going to destroy the venue. They were just, it was insane, the energy. And it was just, those two shows just kind of solidified, I think, the success for that band, at least as far as we felt about it, you know. And it just
right.
it seemed like things were just going to go great. And Kevin Lovejoy was the keyboard player at the time, and he was another guy that came in and really elevated the musicianship,
and
the band live was just on fire, and it was great.
We were in a band in Houston together. His mom was my cousin's Montessori school teacher.
Right on.
And I used to take my cousin to school every day.
Yeah.
And his mom said, "Hey, you know, my son's here from North Texas, Chris, and my other son there started a band. Don't you do something band stuff? They're looking for a singer." And I was like, "Oh, I'll go over there." So I went over there.
I love Kevin Lovejoy.
Me too. I love that dude. He won't be on this show. He refuses, flat out refuses.
Why?
Because he's angry. I think he doesn't want his anger to come out on the show.
Oh,
I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean,
I don't know. I had my shit with me one day and I ran into him Flipknot. So I was like, "Come on, let's do it." And he's like, "I'm not going to get on that thing." That's what he said.
He should totally be on this show.
I know.
If I see him, I'll yell at him and tell him to be on the show.
It's nothing but love for him here at my house. So you guys, how long did you go on playing with them until you left again?
End of 2006.
Okay.
So maybe another 4 years or so.
Wow. So more TV shows.
Yeah.
You guys did Stranger Than Fiction soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we did Gimme Fiction and that.
Yeah.
We did that record and then just a bunch of great stuff. I mean, playing great, bigger shows, bigger venues. You know, that's when we were playing like multiple nights at the Fillmore in San Francisco. And, you know, we played Castle Clinton in New York, and we were playing Irving Plaza, and we were playing Nokia Live, and we were playing, and we started opening for bigger bands. We did a couple shows at the Greek theaters in California with Death Cab for Cutie. And we did another ACL TV show taping and more ACL festivals. And we toured Europe with Interpol, which was insane.
Wow.
Because they're, you know, like treated like gods over there. Yeah. And especially at that time, because we did the tour for the record right after their debut. And, we were playing like, you know, small like soccer arenas and stuff with them.
Wow.
It was amazing. And we were on buses. That, you know, Gimme Fiction was when we started getting onto buses and stuff like that. And actually having like the start of like a small crew, you know, maybe a sound guy and a monitor guy and a tour manager.
Makes all the difference too, you know, especially a sound guy.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff Bird, that was the beginning of like the band's relationship with Jeff Bird, who is now, you know, I think he's still Spoon's sound guy, but he's now doing sound for so many great bands like Explosions in the Sky and White Rabbits. I mean, he's gone from, you know, mixing bands at like 200 seat clubs to now I think he did like Wembley Stadium a year or so ago with White Rabbits because they opened up for Muse or something there. And now he's from San Francisco, and he's a guy that we met through John Vanderslice, and just amazing
times. you met a lot of these guys. Are you friends with like Death Cab for Cutie guys and Pavement guys and
it was great. I mean, and I got to meet, you know, some of my heroes.
Who all did you meet?
I mean, Spoon played a South by Southwest festival show at La Zona Rosa, and I think we shared the bill with, you know, Robin Hitchcock and John Cale from the Velvet Underground. And you know, just getting to meet these people and getting to be on the same bill with these people. And I remember we didn't get to meet them or share the stage with them, but I remember like at an ACL festival show, we went on like right after Elvis Costello played and getting to like hear him play and end his set. And then we got to play. It was surreal.
Yeah.
You know? It was incredible. It was amazing.
Yeah. So then how did that come to a close for you? How did that end?
Fine, okay. You know, but it was just like, it was like the same problems that I'd had before exemplified, you know, and I think a lot of the success was coming in there. And I think that, you know, Britt's my friend and I care about him and I appreciate all the great times that we've had together, but our working relationship was just really strained, and we have very different ideas about what a band is.
Sure.
You know, and so I couldn't really do that. I didn't want my life to be, you know, about having to cultivate a certain image, and I didn't want it to have to be about playing bass in a certain way according to how another person dictates it to me.
Sure.
And if I was going to play bass, it had to be low slung like Duff McKagan and Guns N' Roses, or, you know, it's just not the way that I do music, you know? And so, and I'd met my wife, well, she was my girlfriend at the time, and, you know, I wanted to concentrate on that, and I wanted to do more freelance music work, and I wanted to kind of make plans for the future as far as doing music until I'm dead, you know? So I left and went back to school and finished my degree, which I had dropped out of school to start touring with Spoon 10 years prior. And then I started getting...
The history degree or the music?
I finished my history degree, and then I've now since gone back to grad school for a music degree.
Right.
And
that's what you're going to today.
Yeah.
Going to grad school.
Yeah. I got to go to grad school in about an hour. But, so, you know, and then I got to do a bunch of freelance stuff. And then it's just been amazing. I've got to play with John Dee and Bob Schneider and, you know, all of these people who are huge, huge Austin music institutions, you know. And, you know, I hope John Dee doesn't mind me calling him an institution if he ever hears me saying this.
But. Oh, no, he'd love that. Maybe not. So playing with him was fun?
It was great.
I like John Dee a lot.
I love John Dee.
We're good pals.
It was great. I mean... Getting to play with these people was such a completely different experience than playing with Spoon, because with John Dee especially, like, there was no rehearsal, there was no set list. You know, he would tell me to learn 15 songs, and then maybe he would call out 7 of them on stage, and so it was very much like seat of your pants kind of stuff playing.
But who was playing drums when you were doing that?
Joey Sheffield.
Oh, he's a great guy. Like, Joey's amazing.
Yeah.
Chris Searles is amazing. JJ is amazing.
Yeah, and I've gotten to play with, you know, JJ on recording sessions and...
Oh, with Bob Schneider.
With Bob Schneider, and, well, a lot of that was with Conrad Shakroon, but...
Oh, I love.
With JJ, I did stuff with, a couple of artists at various studios kind of around town.
And I just saw a great show with Conrad playing drums the other night.
He's amazing.
Ian McLaughlin.
Yeah,
I mean. He's fantastic.
I got to do Little Creatures. Lovely Creatures, yeah. The Bob Schneider record and probably his biggest single, you know, Romeo and Juliet. I'm the guy playing bass
on that.
Yeah.
I'll put that at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Even though you're gonna say that you didn't play bass on that song. So now I have to keep that.
So
song.
Do I have an is there an editing issue going on?
I don't edit. I edited once. I had one member of a band say that another member of the band's face as he'd gotten older looked like an exploded firework, but in Spanish. And then he called me afterwards and he was like, dude, if this guy hears this, he's gonna kill me. So I took it off.
That's nice of you, man.
Yeah. There was another one. There was one band where I was like, oh, so your singer just had a baby. And they're like, and then afterwards they're like, man, like our management doesn't want us to talk about that he had a baby or got married. And I'm like, what is it, like 1962? The dude's like 36 years old or something like that.
Wasn't that the thing with John Lennon? You know, right. They didn't want the press to know that he was married to Cynthia Lennon and all that
having
stuff.
Having a baby.
Yeah.
Well.
But yeah. So I got to do that.
Okay. And so how was that? Did you feel,
great.
Was that fun to work on that?
Totally.
Is it freedom?
Totally.
Who was the guy, Dwight?
Yep.
Is that the guy?
Mm-hmm.
How's he?
He's fantastic. And his studio is beautiful. I was just pinching myself when I was walking up there. I was like, man, I don't know if I've ever recorded at a studio where you walk out of the studio door and you could jump right into a pool, you know, because he's got a studio built in his behind his house. And he lives out in, I think, Driftwood or Dripping Springs area. And,
I should get that guy on my show, huh? He's done some cool stuff.
You should totally get that guy on your show. He's got such a great vibe for when you're working with him. I mean, he's a taskmaster and he likes to work fast and he wants to get it done, but he's so like focused when you're doing it and he's got a drummer's perspective, so
Oh right, yeah, he's a drummer.
But he also is a songwriter, so he's got the big picture too. So as a bass player, it's really easy to work with him because you know, he can talk to me about rhythm and groove and where he wants, maybe is hearing the bass placed, but at the same time, you know, he's a songwriter, so he's got a larger kind of view over how the tune should unfold, you know,
right.
So it was great. I had a great time. I mean, a lot of that stuff is, I have to thank George Reef because he kind of championed me to a lot of people and a lot of work came via him. Oh yeah, totally.
I have a great amount of affection for George Reef.
Has he been on this show?
No, I need to get him on here.
George Reef. And I don't know the guy's last name, but Billy D, who plays with a lot of the country artists, Dale Watson, people like that. Those two guys are probably, in my opinion, humble opinion, are the two greatest bass players in Austin, Texas. George Reef is one of my influences just as much as Steve Harris from Iron Maiden or Cliff Burton from Metallica or Paul McCartney. I mean, George Reef, just his work on Contiki. I mean, Cotton Mather's Contiki was such a huge record.
Oh, yeah, that was
record.
Him on that record.
Yeah, such a huge record for Spoon.
Yeah,
you know, and
really?
Yeah, huge record. And George's playing on it is just so... I don't know if he would like this comparison, but it reminds me a lot of, like, Bruce Thomas from Elvis Costello and The Attractions, you know? Like, it's really tasteful, but at the same time, it's kind of experimental, and it's not what you would expect, and I don't know. I think he's just fabulous. He should be on the show.
Yeah, he should be on the
show. Get him on here, man. He's played with some amazing people, too. He could tell you stories.
Oh, yeah. I've been around him. I mean, we've been friends since, 1989.
Yeah.
I saw he lived in Dallas and I was in a band in Houston and he was in a band called Big Loud Dog that was like a kind of a power pop trio. And I worked at Whole Foods in Houston and he was dating this girl, Valerie, who was my friend, who was the manager of the cheese department. Like the day after I saw him play, he's walking through Whole Foods and I literally ran through Whole Foods like, dude, I saw you play. So I became friends with him like that.
Yeah,
totally freaking him out.
Yeah, he's You know, I would love to know how many bands or people George Reef has played with, or how many, you know, bands he's sat in with or been hired. I mean,
I went and played on a session for him and Scrappy were producing A Girl, and I went and played last year.
Cool.
And it was a great, like, just hanging out with him is awesome. Mm-hmm. He's such a great guy.
He is.
Yeah.
You know, and he's, you know, I think that he's got a great, I played on a session for him where he was producing it, and, you know, I think he's got a really good feel for that role, right. You know, being a producer and stuff, and kind of seeing the overall picture. I mean, bass players seem to do that well.
And he has that, like you, like a calm, you know.
Yeah. Demeanor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Calm
yeah.
and calming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that when you're in a situation like that in a recording studio, it usually is more beneficial than not, you know, when you can be sure. calming and keep the energy.
The
grace under pressure kind of thing.
Yeah, but also like the hang is such an important thing when you're in those close quarters mm-hmm. so long and pressure,
mm-hmm.
in a pressureful situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's other, so you talked about the Kon-Tiki album and how that was a big thing. And then you played with Future Clouds and Radar.
Yeah.
I saw you play with them.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the only times. Did you play when Darren played too?
Yep. Yeah.
At Antone's?
Yep.
I saw that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was amazing
that?
Too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I keep saying this, but I mean, I just feel so lucky to have played with, you know, all of these guys that are just kind of titans in the Austin music scene, or just kind of nationally in a lot of ways. I mean, Robert Harrison was a completely different band leader than Britt was, but they're both so keyed into exactly what their vision is. And that
seems like that.
Yeah. And that's was the great thing about Robert was, I think probably some of the best work I've ever done, if not the best work I've ever done, has been with Robert, because I've never experienced something where somebody can pull the best out of me as well as he can, you know,
really?
just in the way that he kind of leads and the ideas that he offers up and how he loves to just like live in the moment with music, especially and how creative he is. He's, you know, he's one of those guys who just seems to be.
He seems hyper. Like the first Future Clouds and Radar was a double record.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And he, you know, he's always creating and he's always writing and he's always coming up with new ideas. I learned an immense amount about playing bass from playing in Future Clouds and recording with Future Clouds. So it was great. And getting to hang out with Darren and playing with him. And that guy's another person that I love, but at the same time, I want to choke him because he's so damn talented, you know? Because
dude, imagine being in a band with him. It drives me nuts. The other night, I got in the most inane argument with him at a gig. I was so stupid. But he's like, hey, so on Time For Me To Fly, you didn't sing this backing vocal. So we just worked it up. And I was like, yeah, I don't sing on that. He's like, no, you do. Like the other day, we worked it up in rehearsal. I'm like, no, I don't sing on that. Totally, like he's like, no, you do. And it's like he's so nice that he goes, okay, well, you didn't, but if you did, would you sing this part? And then I was like, oh, I did sing on it, I'm sorry.
And he knows like all the vocal parts.
I know,
that's the other thing
me.
Too. I mean, there was one time that we were playing in Future Clouds, and I think that we were either doing a cover tune of a band or we were doing maybe a Cotton Mather tune
right.
that we were going to bring into the set, and he was playing drums at the same time that he was in his head hearing the chord progressions going by and yelling out the chord progressions.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he had necessarily learned the song.
No, he just knows.
He just knew him.
He's like,
yeah, he was like A minor and then go to a D. And like, if he was teaching me a vocal part, he would be like, no, goes like this. And don't go too flat on this note because you'll want to go flat there. And it was just,
he's kind of like a white prince.
Yeah.
I've said that for a long time.
They did something for a Beatles day.
I was there.
Yeah, where you guys sang Because or something?
No. I was just there.
Well, Britt was telling me that he came
yeah.
and that Darren basically like came in and arranged
the entire vocal
part and sang everybody's part and showed them exactly what they had to sing, and it was like
I remember having this conversation with Britt because he was like, oh, Darren came in and totally fucking saved my ass. I'm like, dude, like 5 years before that, I was playing a Beatles thing, and I was like, man, we should get Darren to come in and play drums, because that way, you know, he'll know it.
Yeah, he'll
and
know
so
that.
Not only did he know it, but like, I mean, literally, he worked all of our shit out, and yeah, like we started playing stuff, right? But that's funny. I remember that night. And,
I mean, that's the great thing about him too, though, is that he does it in such a generous kind of kind,
oh, yeah, yeah, he's not,
way, you know, he's not overbearing. He's always with kindness. And
no, he's doing it just because he's paying reverence to that music. He's, yeah, like, hey, these guys spent some time doing this shit. Like, listen, it's, yeah, really good. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
it's, yeah, that's one of the qualities.
So, what are you doing now? Where are you at? You're in graduate school.
Yeah,
teaching.
I'm teaching.
You
music.
Teach a class.
I teach a couple classes at Austin Community College.
That's
I teach
awesome.
A couple music courses. Yeah.
What are the courses about?
I teach bass, just okay. like private
Straight
lessons, and
bass.
Then I teach a rock ensemble.
Yeah, I
which
saw
is
that.
Great. And this summer I'm going to teach history of popular music there.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I'm enjoying.
How do you get a job like that?
I have a friend who is on faculty there, and they had a guy who left who had been teaching the bass lessons, and he left, and so they need to fill that role.
But like then, a popular music?
Oh, because my degree right now, my master's degree that I'm almost done with, is in music history.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they're wanting to offer the course during the summer, and I've been like hounding on them. Hey, man, I want to get experience doing a lecture course. And so they, you know, I just kept at it, and my boss
so
gave me
the
opportunity.
Do you keep up with pop music?
I do, totally.
Do you?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm playing in a band right now. We're getting ready to release a record. I'm in a band called Monahans.
Yeah, I saw that.
And we're going to release a record, hopefully, after the first of the year, and I think it's the best record I've ever made. I know that it's probably the most proud I've ever been of a record. And it's kind of gone back to what I was talking about with Requiem. It's very much a band. Like, it's very collaborative. Everybody's bringing in song ideas, and you know, whereas the lead singer he's doing all the lyric writing and all the melody stuff.
Right.
Various people are bringing in tunes, you know, music. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it's, you know, so I'm doing that, and I'm playing in like kind of this R&B instrumental jazz kind of light jazz band called the Gavin Tobone Quartet. And we're doing,
I see you guys
like,
doing whip-in.
Yeah, we've been doing a whip-in kind of first Thursday thing, and we're playing tunes by like the Meters and Jimmy Smith and Thelonious Monk, and that's great because it's kind of getting me into a different headspace.
Yeah,
and
I was wondering, did you ever play that stuff? Because in all of the stuff, it's not to sound like I'm the king of funk or anything, but like,
right.
You know, it's a whiter, more
yeah.
Anglo, you know, Beatley kind of music.
Totally. No, that's what I was kind of formally trained in high school and in private
right.
lessons was in jazz and stuff like that. But, and then on my private time, my like, you know, home time, I mostly like study, you know, maybe James Jamerson or
yeah.
like R&B people that played with like Aretha and
yeah.
Staple Singers. And so I'm really into it, but it's great because the musicians that I'm playing with in that band are just completely insanely good and no nonsense, no drama. It's just hardcore playing. And so I'm doing that and still doing some freelance work and having a good time, married and have a house. And
so how you have a very comprehensive website. It's joshuazarbo.com or .net. joshuazarbo.net.
You did your homework, man.
I really don't. I quickly look over everything and before I do it. Like, I printed this out, and I'm just kind of, like, glancing at it. What's this video game thing?
Oh, yeah. I did the soundtrack to Red Dead Redemption, The Undead Nightmare, which is probably one of the coolest things I've ever done, which is Red Dead Redemption is a hugely popular movie based on, it's like in a Western kind of landscape, like a spaghetti Western.
Yeah.
And the initial video game was done by all the guys that had done like a lot of the Ennio Morricone stuff, like the
really
yeah a lot of the guys that had maybe played, you know, maybe they'd played like jaw harp or you know, harmonica or stuff on it or percussion. A lot of those people did the soundtrack for that, and it was hugely successful. Well, they did a second kind of offset or kind of off-kilter version of the game, but they did it now with zombies in this Western landscape, and so they wanted it to be kind of more electronic and rock-based.
Uh-huh.
And so a guy that I met that used to be in Friends of Dean Martinez,
uh-huh.
Bill Elm.
Oh, yeah. I love Bill Elm.
He's great. And I met him at a recording session that I did just randomly, and I have this foot pedal, which is a Morley Power fuzz wah that
yeah.
Cliff Burton from Metallica used a lot. And I brought it to that initial session for weird stuff, just for weird sounds. And he really liked it and kind of, I guess, maybe made a mental note of it. And a year or two later, he just called me out of the blue and said, I'm doing this soundtrack. I need some fuzz bass.
The other guy do that.
Yeah.
A lot. I hung out with them one time in New York.
I
hung out with Bill one time in New York because he was there having meetings with people about that very thing.
Well, then, and so I went over to his place over in, I think, Zilker Park. He just had like a little home studio, and I played a bunch of bass and kind of fuzz bass stuff on that.
That's cool.
It's been amazing because it's, you know, it's out there in like video game culture. And if I'm ever talking to people about, oh yeah, and I just did this random like video game thing, you just see like a bunch of kids that are just like, whoa, he played on Red Dead Redemption, The Undead Nightmare, you know, and they're really geeked out by it. So it's pretty cool to have that experience.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So people can find out where you're playing at joshuazarbo.net. It's very well done, and it seems like you have a mailing list. I was thinking about signing up on it.
I've never sent anything out. I'm terrible about that. I'm fairly good about updating it, but
it's a good comprehensive website.
Thanks,
you get an
man.
Idea of who you are.
Thank you.
Pretty quickly,
thanks,
which
man.
Is good. You know,
yeah.
I mean, in a time, you know, what's gonna, yeah,
yeah.
Well, it helps freelance work and like
totally.
School people can
totally.
Go see it.
Totally. This has been fun, Johnny.
Hey, thank you. I like the way that you tied in Requiem at the end, like, and I'm back to Requiem, like just from the beginning of the thing. I was like, I need to start doing that. It's brilliant. So the other thing I was going to say is, you say you listen to pop music now, obviously.
Oh yeah, so I mostly listen to pop music or pop, yeah, popular music.
Where are you with Carly Rae Jepsen?
Carly Rae. Who?
Are you joking?
No.
I just asked if you listen to pop music. It's like the biggest song of the summer, Call Me Maybe.
I don't know. When I say pop music, I'm thinking like popular music. Like, yeah, I still listen to, you know, radio.
Oh, I was just about to start asking you shit about Flo Rida.
No. I'm sorry. Not necessarily the radio version of pop music. I mostly listen to... I thought you meant like, hey man, are you mostly in academia now and just listen to like, you know, yeah. Webster Lewis and you're listening to just, you know, like weird stuff, you know, and like.
Or do you still listen to?
To rock and roll.
Yeah.
You still got your
Badfinger? You like Badfinger?
I love Badfinger.
That's good.
The Ivies, right?
Darren's not a big Badfinger guy.
No?
No, and we had this conversation the other day that was really funny. So it was like, oh, you know, on paper, you should really like Todd Rundgren. But he doesn't.
He doesn't?
No, he said he tried to listen to something, anything, and listen to like four songs and turn it off. But on paper, Darren should be a huge fan.
I totally 100% concur with that. Yeah. Like, it almost seems like Todd Rundgren, in a way, is kind of the personification of Darren. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like...
like if Darren wasn't a person.
like this mad kind of like multi-instrumental just pop genius in a way, you know? And... I don't know.
So what nights are you playing at the Whip Inn?
Every first Thursday and then of the month. So I guess the next one will be the first Thursday in December. I don't know when this is coming out, Johnny. Where am I in the queue, Johnny? Am I going to get bumped ahead
in the queue?
No.
I think you're Friday.
Wow.
Yeah.
I got to tell my mom and dad.
No, I'm behind. It's me that's behind. There's no queue. The queue ran out because there was a couple that got messed up a couple weeks ago.
Like,
and that fell behind.
Technically got messed up.
No. Just
scheduling.
You know, Austin, dude.
I totally want
to do it, man. But like, I can't because, man, I didn't realize I have this.
Yeah. I know. Sometimes I feel like when I'm talking with people and setting up stuff, I wonder if I'm like the exact opposite and almost overbearing in that way that I'm like, okay. And when I email people back, I'm like, okay, here's the time. Here's when I'm coming.
Yeah.
Here's when I'm planning the show up. Maybe I'll send you a text message ahead of time to let you know that.
I have to do it like that though.
That's good.
You know, I actually had to postpone one that I had set up for Monday because my voice was just messed up.
From gigs and singing?
From gigs, allergies, maybe the Hustler Club on Saturday night in Shreveport. I don't know. I really don't. dude, we covered everything, right? You got to go to graduate school.
I do.
So people can find you on there. And if they want to take bass lessons from you, which I was thinking, that's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody. Yeah. Hook me up. I mean, joshuazarbo.net. I'm on Facebook. I'm out there.
And everything's out there. You got an impressive resume.
Thanks, man.
You've done some great stuff, and you are a really nice guy. I'm glad that we finally got to sit down and do this.
Now that this is about to turn off, I want to ask you, though, at some point about meeting Lars Ulrich, because I am a huge, especially the early era of Metallica.
Well, I didn't know him in the early era.
And that's the period that I'm, the first three are classic, but what was that experience like?
Man, I can only tell you, that guy would, I mean, I would stay at his house. I recorded with him. I can play you the only living recording of me, Amy Mann, and Lars Ulrich together.
Nice. I want to hear that. Yes.
I don't know if you do.
Yeah, I do want to hear.
It'll change your feeling about him if you really like him.
You mean the drumming is so...
It's not where it's at.
No.
I jammed with him a lot, like in his house. Like, he's got a jam room, and me and our guy Jimmy, that's good friends with this guy Dwight, we would go in, the three of us. Jimmy would play bass, I'd play guitar, and Lars would play drums, and... One time I recorded with him and Bob Rock. It was wild.
Yeah,
he's a really nice guy, man.
He is, and he's one of those guys that, like, his passion for music makes up for the
technical
limitations.
I'll be honest, he always treated me like I was a fucking genius.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, like, he treated me like I was a... Like, I remember one time I sat down at a piano in his hotel, and I started playing Close to You or something by the Carpenters, and he was like, oh. Dude, I don't know how you do this. And I was like, what? And he's like, I don't know how you just fucking sit down at an instrument and then play and sing and entertain. It's like, I don't know anyone who can do that. And I just looked at him and I was like, the fuck kind of people do you hang out with? Because like in my world, if you can't do this, people will kick your ass.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it was
he was, well, it sounds like he was a cool guy though.
Really nice. Yeah. And I mean, I'll tell you this, there was one thing. Like, he said a lot of smart-ass shit to me, but there was this one night I was staying there, and he was like, oh, show me these pictures that you brought me, because I brought him some pictures of us, and they were contact sheets, and he's looking through the contact sheets with a loop and everything, and he's like, dude, you're so skinny. Fuck, I get worried about you. Are you sure you don't want me to make you something to eat? I swear to God. So I'm like, no, 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 dude, I'm fine. So he leaves me in my room at his house, and the little phone goes, ook, Johnny, it's Lars. And he's calling me through the phone. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, dude, I'm in the kitchen. It's nothing for me to just make you a turkey. I swear to God, like, he was my grandma or something. Like, it's nothing. I'll just make you a turkey sandwich. So I had that weird experience with him. That was always the experience I always wanted to impart onto, like, kids that were huge fans of his. Like,
yeah.
There is something pretty nice, like, when he's saying that stuff. And he was always really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's always kind of come across as that kind of guy. I mean, I know that a lot of people kind of, slag him because he's a loud mouth. And,
yeah.
You know, but, man.
I'll be honest with you.
Talk about another guy who had a vision for something.
Yeah.
And followed through with it.
Totally.
To, like, the...
Exactly, and that's why, I mean, I was never a fan of theirs. I really didn't know their music very much at all,
yeah.
Except what was really popular. And
listen to The Call of Cthulhu.
That was a big joke in our band, just the name of that song.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Listen to it, and then listen to the bass playing.
I will.
You'll go.
Yeah.
All right, man. All right.
Yeah, fuck yeah. The guy is great. All right, so that's a good way to end the thing, I think.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Joshua. Bye.
Oh, yeah. Joshua Zarbo. I like that guy.
That guy's a good guy. Good guy. Plus, he loves George Reef. Man, good golly. So check him out, joshuazarbo.net. You can hire him to play on your stuff. He's amazing. That's what you should do. Or go check him out when he's playing with some of these bands that he's playing with. Fantastic guy. He's going to send me some music from the Monahans. That's his band that has a record coming out pretty soon. Maybe we'll get them on. Get the whole band on. Talk to them about stuff. I'd like to congratulate Barack Obama for winning the presidency. I know that wasn't easy. So that happened. All right. Maybe you can follow me on Twitter at Johnny Gowdy. You like our Facebook page. How did I get here? Go there, like it, and then you'll know stuff that's going on. Shit, I should have taken a picture with Joshua. I never do that. I don't do it enough. All right. I'm going to stop being mad at myself. Subscribe on iTunes. Do that and know that I love you. Here's a song from Spoon called That's Just the Way We Get By. We talked about it earlier. Here we go. Let's get down.
We get high in back seats of cars. We break into mobile homes. We go to sleep to shake a pill. Never wake up
That's the way we get by. The way we get by. All that's the way we get by. The way we get by. We go out in stormy weather. We rarely practice discern. We make love to some weird sin. We seek out the tacit.